When Carolina de Robertis was 12 years old, her father told her that she reminded him of his mother, who was crazy and a poet. He poured out all the family history he could remember, so she could one day write a book about it. And today, Carolina has done that. The Invisible Mountain weaves stories of Carolina's ancestors with that of Uruguay, the country she grew up feeling connected to but not knowing. The Invisible Mountain is Carolina de Robertis' first novel, just out from Knopf and already translated into 11 languages. At just 23 years old, Carolina founded the Spanish language hotline at Bay Area Women Against Rape. She later co-founded the After Abortion Counseling Talk Line, Exhale. She has taught writing at Merritt College and is a new mom with her wife, filmmaker Pamela Harris. Carolina, welcome to Women's Magazine.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
So The Invisible Mountain is a multi-generational and multinational story, beginning on the first day of the 20th century in Uruguay and tracing the history of three generations of women in one family. Tell us about these three main characters.
Well, the three main characters, Pajarita, Eva, and Salome, are in a lot of ways inspired by my own ancestors, by one of my great-grandmothers and my paternal grandmother, and then by people of my parents' generation. I just was really passionate about learning more about my roots in Uruguay, having not grown up there, but feeling like it was such a big part of my identity, and growing up with family stories in which the men often had very long paragraphs. I knew the names of all my great-great-grandfathers on one side, and yet the grandmothers, their stories were shorter. We get these little lines, and I wanted to know more about where they came from and what history would look like through their eyes. And that was part of birthing the book.
Your three heroines are sort of feminist archetypes in a way. Pajarita is a healer, Eva is a poet, and Salome is a revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And some familiar characters also make appearances, like Che Guevara and Evita Perón. So how much is this meant to be a history of Uruguay and in sort of Latin America in general, because part of it takes place in Argentina and also Brazil? And how much of it is about the specific destinies of three pretty extraordinary women?
Well, that's a really good question, and I don't know that I have the answer to it. I think every reader might find their own answer about whether it's fundamentally about the history or about the women. For me, it really is all of the above. The book is sort of almost a braid of three different strands: my own family stories, actual history of Uruguay and Latin America, and thirdly, pure imagination, things that are absolutely created and made up. So, you know, these three women, they have their own destinies, their own lives and situations. Eva has her private challenges and the private obstacles that she has to overcome. And then she also, you know, comes up against history. I mean, I am also fascinated by history and the way that it interweaves with people's everyday realities. You know, we don't live in a vacuum. And the everyday consequences of historical moments really fascinate me. So Eva Perón, yes, and Juan Perón and Che Guevara make appearances in the book, but so do other much lesser known historical figures like Ernesto Bravo, who was a young man who was brutalized by the police in Argentina and framed by the Peronist police for a crime he didn't commit. And his presence is in the book. Also Dan Mitrione, who was a torture trainer brought by the United States to Uruguay in the late 60s. And he was actually kidnapped by the revolutionary Tupamaros, who are an armed guerrilla movement in Uruguay. And he's an actual character in the book. He shows up. And of course, my fictional characters are the ones who interface with him. Salome is the third generation in the book, and she actually becomes an armed revolutionary at the age of 15. And this was something that I really wanted to understand better and get into the skin of, you know, what happened in Uruguay in the late 60s with this revolutionary movement that sort of ended up falling into a dictatorship that was U.S. backed. How did this happen, and how did it feel in the skin of the people, and particularly the women?
So how did you get into the skin of a revolutionary? How did you do your research for this book?
I did research in a lot of different ways. I read everything I could get my hands on, which here in the United States is pretty limited, things for in Uruguay. But going back to Uruguay, people handed me books, told me about books. So I read a great deal. And I also talked to people whenever I could. I went back to Uruguay three times in the 9 years it took for this book to get finished. It took me 8 years to write it, 9 years for it to get published. And in that time, I went back three times and spoke with people who had direct experiences with, for example, the revolutionary movement, or who didn't have direct experiences, but it had affected them. You know, it's historical moments and waves, they touch all of us in so many different manners that everybody has a story. So I listened to a lot of people's stories. I also did research by walking the streets in Uruguay and just, you know, as a novelist, the wonderful thing is that you can use absolutely everything. So you can use the smell of a street and the way that a song from the radio intermingles with the sound of a car and the sound of someone talking and, you know, the scent of a restaurant and chorizos cooking a las brasas in the restaurant. And all of those things can spark an idea, a theme, a line of writing, some words that can weave into the book. So I did that kind of extremely messy, informal research as well. And I also, you know, these women do come up against the violence that is so common in the lives of women. And working at Bay Area Women Against Rape, listening to over 1,000 rape survivors and their loved ones about their experiences was another way in which the pool that I could draw from was enlarged and enriched. I did not at all use any particular client's story, since those are absolutely confidential. But the trauma that people experienced, the resilience and incredible power that people used to heal, all of those things that I got to witness up close were part of what fed me as well.
So what's the significance of the title, The Invisible Mountain?
Well, Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay, is the city that most of the book is set in. And its name, Montevideo, comes from the Portuguese Montevideo, I see a mountain. And there were Portuguese sailors from Europe who came and saw land for the first time after a long voyage and said, Montevideo, I see a mountain, there's land. And the great irony of this naming of this city is that it's an incredibly flat terrain. There's no mountain really in all of Uruguay. It's very temperate and rolling hills, nothing steep about it. There's this very low hill that is called El Cerro that was the mountain in question. So it's really an ironic name that there's this mountain. Where is this mountain? Where is this mountain that we can all look to, rely on? All of my characters in some way are reaching or striving for something bigger and greater than themselves, something they can't see or name. They take a lot of leaps and risks in their lives for something invisible. So on the one hand, that's the invisible mountain. And on the other hand, it's sort of an evocation of Montevideo, this unassuming and yet so beautiful city that is also very invisible internationally, as is the country of Uruguay. People don't write much about Uruguay. I've even gone to anthologies of Latin American literature, and there's nothing, there's no Uruguay, even though there's such a rich tradition of poetry and fiction in Uruguay. Mario Benedetti, Horacio Quiroga, Cristina Peri Rossi, not to mention Eduardo Galeano, of course, and so many others. And yet Uruguay is so underseen and undersung.
I felt when I was reading parts of the book that I could definitely hear the influence of Isabel Allende and Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Although I'm reminded of one of the lines that I found most enjoyable in the book, where Eva meets a poet who says, oh, of course, the lighthouse in your poem is a reference to Virginia Woolf. And she says, oh, yes, of course, having completely forgotten about the existence of Virginia Woolf.
Right.
So
exactly.
Perhaps I am wrong to make those assumptions. But who are some of the writers who inspired your work?
Well, you know, I did read 100 Years of Solitude when I was 13 years old, sort of found it on my parents' bookshelf and read it in the back of science class. And actually, the other students teased me because it had a very torrid looking cover. And they said, oh, you're reading a trashy romance. And really, it was when I was 12 that my father had a midlife crisis and told me all these family stories and said, you are a lot like my mother, who was a crazy woman and a poet, and so you should write a book one day with these stories. So I carried that with me, this notion of writing a book out of these family stories. From the age of 12, 13, I find Garcia Marquez, I sort of stumble across it. So I can't deny that that's in the book. And I was really inspired by the notion of a story that spans generations, a story in which you can't fully understand one character without knowing who her parents were and who her parents' parents were and who people were even five generations back. That concept that we are affected by the people long before us, that they're in our stories, that they're in our bones, that they're in the way that we do and don't experience the world and the challenges we face, whether we know that or not, is something that I think does happen in Latin American literature. At the same time, you know, I'm inspired by a lot of different literature. And what's interesting to me, even about Garcia Marquez, is he actually was very influenced by Kafka. He read Kafka's Metamorphosis and said, wow, a guy wakes up and he's a beetle. And that reminds me of the stories my grandfather told me and makes me think about how I could write literature. And we don't call Kafka a magical realist, because he's European. And that's not what Europeans do in our conception. But I think that magical realism, surrealism, is part of a much bigger stream that goes all the way back to the Odyssey and the Iliad, really, and is in literature from a lot of different places.
Do you have a favorite book?
Oh, goodness.
If you were stranded on a desert island and could only take one book, do you have an idea of what it might be?
Can I pick three? Rumi's Collected Poetry, Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman, and Beloved by Toni Morrison.
Do you want to read a little bit from the book?
Sure. I can read. I'll read the first page. Chapter 1, The Girl Who Appeared in a Tree. When Salome finally wrote to her daughter, by then a young woman, a stranger, thousands of miles away, she said, "Everything that disappears is somewhere, as if physics could turn back time and save them both." It was a maxim she'd learned in school. Energy is neither lost nor created. Nothing truly goes away. People are energy, too, and when you cannot see them, they've just changed places or changed forms, or sometimes both. There is the exception of black holes, which swallow things without leaving even the slightest trace, but Salome let her pen keep moving as if they did not exist. Her skirts were wet and clung to her legs, and her pen moved and moved without her hand seeming to push it, forming the spires and spikes and loops of cursive words, sharp T's and J's, Y's and G's with knots at their base as though to tie themselves together, to tie women back together. And she wrote the loop, and as she wrote, the loops grew large, as if more rope were needed to bind what had blown apart inside her, and not only inside her, but around her and before her, in her mother's days, her grandmother's days, the hordes of stories Salome had not lived through, but that came to her as stories do, copiously, uninvited, sometimes in an easy sprawl, sometimes with a force that could drown you or spit you up to heaven. Other stories had never come. They went untold. They left hollow silence in their place. But if it was true that everything that disappeared was somewhere, then even those still breathed and glittered somewhere in the hidden corners of the world.
Tell us about your life as a writer. Do you write full time or do you do other work? Do you write every day at the same time or is it more sporadic?
In the course of writing this book, I wrote whenever I could, and I was working my behind off all the time to pay the rent, to found a women's health organization, to pay my way through graduate school at different times in the process. So I have written while working full time. It can be done. You can do it. If you have a book inside you, you just have to make the time to write. You have to make it with a crowbar. Now I write full time. You know, you just have to get to know the way that you write. I've come to understand that I write best in long chunks of time. So if I have to choose, I would rather have 6 hours on one day and then not write for a few days, then write, you know, 20 minutes a day or an hour a day. That's not how I work.
Were there ever times when you thought this will just never be done?
There were many, many, many times when I thought that. I thought that I was done writing this book in 2004. I had sort of done my best at that point. Since then, I've gotten incredible editorial support and advice, and the manuscript has doubled as well as changed dramatically in that time. I did a lot of heavy revision. It's such a sprawling book. It spans 90 years and many countries and many characters and situations that it took a long time to find a way for it to all cohere. In addition, it was my first book, and I think the first book teaches you how to write along the way. The first book is your teacher.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on my second novel, which is set in Argentina, about 20 years after the dictatorship, and it's about a young woman raised in a military family whose world is sort of shattered when she discovers the ghost of one of the desaparecidos in her living room. And the desaparecidos from the 70s, of course. He's wet and dripping because he was dropped from an airplane into the sea after being kidnapped and tortured by the government. And the book is about this young woman's journey in getting to know this ghost as he recovers his memories and the way that that forces her to confront her hidden past.
Carolina, thanks so much for taking the time to come and talk to us about your book, and best of luck with it and your next one and your baby and everything else.
Thank you so much. Such an honor and such a joy.
Carolina de Robertis will be reading from The Invisible Mountain this Thursday at Booksmith on Haight Street at 7:30 p.m. And she'll also be reading next Friday at A Great Good Place for Books in Oakland and the following Thursday at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley. She'll also be making appearances in a bunch of other cities around the country. You can find those dates and more information about the book on her website, which is carolinaderobertis.com.